This podcast is part of the C-Suite Radio Network, turning the volume up on business.
Welcome to the Business Power Hour, hosted by Deb Creer. Join us as Deb talks with her guests, experts in their fields, as they share real-life stories and techniques to power up your business.
Good morning, good morning. I am Deb Creer, and I am passionate about giving professionals the tools that they need to make themselves and their businesses as successful as possible. And today we're going to have so much fun talking about the future and innovation and all those fun things that come with it. And so please join me in welcoming Bill Sanders to our program. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Deb. It's a delight to be here.
You know, it is, I love talking about things like this. I'm a science fiction fan, you know, all of these various things. But at the same point, I also love knowing how we got to where we are today, you know, through technology, through innovation, all these various things. And so that's really what we're going to talk about. But let me tell people a little bit about you first. So Bill Sanders is a business transformation and process innovation expert. Using his proven and holistic approach, Bill rapidly bridges the execution gap between strategy and results. He identifies the misalignments between strategy, goals, processes, and behavior, and then designs elegant solutions that close those gaps, accelerating growth, profitability, and innovation. Bill's expertise has attracted over 200 organizations, including such global brands as Google, Microsoft, PepsiCo, General Mills, Lipton, Hewlett-Packard, Sprint, and WebEx. He is Principal and Managing Director of Roebling Strauss, Inc., a management consultancy in the San Francisco Bay Area, focused on organizational and process innovation. He is also the co-author of a recently published book, From Hierarchy to High Performance. So again, Bill, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and thank you for such a great introduction.
You know, it's always such fun to get to learn about my guests, but then what it makes me wonder is, how did you get where you are today? You know, because we all sometimes kind of fall into our careers. Some of us were born into our careers, all these various things. So tell us how you decided that this was your passion.
Well, that is a great question. And I would love to say that I had this miraculous strategy and everything came together. What it boils down to, though, is I was introduced to work at a very early age. I started a paper out at 12. By the time I went to college, I sold two businesses and got friends of mine three different jobs as I left for college. And I enjoyed work. I enjoyed what I learned from it, and I enjoyed making it better. And so that passion has stayed with me throughout a career that has spanned civil engineering, nonprofit curriculum development, e-commerce development. I helped build the first e-commerce platform for Mattel back in the late 90s into stint at consulting. I helped found ROCG Consulting Group, which is about 36 offices worldwide. And then I got recruited into the dark side of advertising and did a stint for about 5 years in both B2B and B2C advertising. In all of those cases, I think my own realization is I'm spending a third or more of my life, sometimes half my life, you know, working. And so if I'm dreading coming to work, that tells me there's a problem. And when I look at the rest of the world right now, and we show with the Gallup poll of like 70% of people are disengaged in their work, it tells me we have a really big problem. And we have a really big problem getting to the goals that we are on company. So for me, I just kind of fell in and pursued those things where I could make the biggest difference as the opportunities arose.
You know, and I find this so interesting because it is that gap between gotta go to work today and, you know, and it, there's commercials, you know, all these various things that do that. But, you know, how many people, whether we are an employee, whether we own our own business, you know, all of these various things, we, you know, it, now granted there are days where it's like, no, really today, but we don't bound from bed and think, wow, I can't wait to get to work today. And it, you know, for the most part, as you said, it is so many people going, okay, I have to get through today, or I have to get through the next year, or, you know, it's funny, we were talking before the program about the recent Mega Millions, where so many people were like, that's my retirement. And how many times do people do that? You know, we're going to say that, you know, playing the lottery is, you know, is their retirement plan, all these various things. And so there is that mismatch. You know, we've all heard the saying, you know, it's not work if you love what you do. And unfortunately, I think for many people, it's work, and it really is just work. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to maintain your own agency. Whether you're the boss or whether you're the worker, you have to be the one that looks at the work you're doing and makes a set of decisions about how it's progressing you forward in life. And if your focus is on the way you're treated or mistreated, what's not right with the system, without coming up with solutions to how to make it better, you're signing your agency over to someone else. I mean, I think this is critical for people that run businesses and people in the C-suite to understand. When your employees close out at the end of the day, they go back home to lives that they have built without a lot of input. They buy homes, they get married, they raise kids, they put kids through college. They are making strategic decisions and taking responsibility and owning their own agency in almost every other area. So when they cross that threshold into your organization, do you want them bringing that same level of energy in? Or do you really want to dictate every little thing and control every little piece of what's going on in your organization? You can't have both. And I think that's one of the key reasons why we're at the 70% is we are living in an antiquated top-down bureaucracy that was built on military approaches from last century. And the incumbent companies are being outrun by the insurgent companies because they're looking at different ways of working and different ways of structuring and different business models entirely.
You know, it's funny. We, in many ways, have negative impressions, thoughts, stereotypes about millennials. But they are the ones who are coming up with this innovation, you know, with a, you know, it doesn't have to be that way type of companies. You know, how many times have we worked in a company and we questioned why we were doing something and we were told, same thing as, you know, at home, that's the way we've always done it. And millennials, especially millennials, are going, now, wait a minute, And we, as that established generation, think, well, wait a minute, that's wrong. And that's actually, we're wrong. We should be the ones looking at how can we change things.
100% agree with you. And one of the reasons we don't is because we're too busy dealing with minutia on a day-to-day basis. We don't give ourselves as leaders enough time to think, to read deeply, to reconsider what's going on out there. I caught myself in it recently with one of my co-authors, Sue Bingham, brought up the issue of, for example, the 90-day period when you can let someone go right away if they don't work out after you hire them. And, you know, I've done that. I've put it in place so many times because I've seen it put in place so many times. I've never deeply thought about it. She's like, look, if you do your hiring process right, what's that communicating to them? We're really not sure you're the right person for this job, so we're going to hold, you know, you're on you're on parole here. So you get the best, you're going to get the best work out of that person for 91 days. Right. Rather than that, why don't you change the attitude? When we hire you, we are hiring you. We expect you to do well here. Here's your roles. Here's your responsibility. Here's your objectives. Here's the help you get. This is very clear. Go be great. Totally different communication.
And you're so, you know, so correct in this because, you know, I think in corporate America, especially any jobs I had, you had that 90-day period where, you know, it, and they said, well, it's for you to also decide if that's where you want to work. But the same thing goes. I mean, you know, if I want to work somewhere, I want to work somewhere. I don't want to think, oh, is this a testing ground? You know, I should have made the right decision to start with.
Well, this also falls back to something that I think is critically important I work with clients on a regular basis is how we think about hiring in general. There's a book out called The Alliance, and in it, Reid Hoffman, who's the founder of LinkedIn, is the one that wrote it. And he's like, look, you know, all of our processes and our hiring and our compensation and our review, all of this is built on an old system that said you go to work for one place when you get out of college and retire 40 years later. Mm-hmm. We know that's not the way it works anymore.
Right.
Why not be honest about it? Why mm-hmm. not hire people for a tour of duty, which is a specific period of time based on the specific goals of what they want to learn and how they want to progress their career forward, and the specific goals that and objectives that the company has that are a match.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And when you do that and you're actually having an honest conversation about, well, this is, you know, you're here for 18 months minimum. Mm-hmm. You're committing to that to us. We're committing to that to you. And as we get to that point, these are the objectives. Here's how you're going to be measured. Here's the quality criteria of the deliverables that we expect you to bring to life. Guess what? Now they're in control of their career. Mm-hmm. There's honest conversations going on. We don't need an annual review process anymore. We need the regular check-ins on how the project or process is going. And then as we near that end, we can start having a different strategic conversation about what's next. What do you want right. to do within this company? Do we help you go get a job somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, that makes sense. But of course, it as you said, it's not the way we have operated. You know, and long gone are the days when you were a career whatever. You know, now my husband he's worked for the same company basically since he got out of college, and mm-hmm. and will, you know, fingers, toes, eyes crossed, stay there till the day he retires. But for the most part, I think you know, it's what, you know, we stay somewhere about 18 months to 2 years, and then we get that itch. You know, and so if you've built in the process where we can deal with that itch, you know, and sometimes it is that they leave. Okay, well, if they were a great employee, let's help them with that next step. You know, or if they're a great employee, let's figure out how we can keep them. You know, so I love this concept.
I had a mentor of mine, who's very influential in my developing management styles and thinking and approaching. And he was running a company. He's president of a software company. And one of his best engineers, who had really topped out at that company, there was not going to be a much bigger place for him to go. And he was feeling like he was getting stuck in a corner of his mm-hmm. career. And he came to my mentor and said, I feel like I not going to make any more money here. I need not really improving my skill set for the last 6 months. I think I need to go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And my mentor's response was, great. Here's what we do. Take 4 weeks off paid. Go see what else is out there. If you want introductions to these other places, let me know. Mm-hmm. And I will help you with that. And if you find a place, great. And if you don't, come back.
Right. So and did he come back?
He came back after 3 weeks and said, there's nothing else out there right here unless I want to move to the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And so he stayed there another year, right? But he stayed there happy another year instead of feeling like he was under pressure or mm-hmm. something else. And then when the time and the opportunity came, he left and picked up a VP or senior VP role somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it is all about having those open lines of communication. You know, I've shared this story before. I was working with someone on their LinkedIn profile. She had been with a company for, you know, quite a few years, but had reached that peak. You know, she thought she couldn't go any further with them. She got that itch. You know, she was ready to go. And the funny thing is, in her LinkedIn summary, she put that, you know, I'm looking for new opportunities, blah, blah, blah. Well, just so happened that her boss saw it, called her into the office and said, so tell me about this. And she was honest and open. You know, she's, you know, mm-hmm. she said, this is what's going on. And the boss looked at her and said, is there a reason you don't want to do that with us? And she'd never considered it. Otherwise, she probably would have brought it up to them. But of mm-hmm. course, when she started exploring that, she thought, well, hey, this is a perfect opportunity, because then she wouldn't be losing benefits. She wouldn't be starting over, you know, all these various things. But of course, we're afraid that if we tell our supervisor, our boss, our manager, whatever, hey, you know, I'm thinking about this, we're going to fall back into those old roles where they're going to say, fine, then go elsewhere and don't let the door hit you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are. I just had a conversation with a client, owns an agency in the Bay Area here 2 days ago on Monday. And her question was, she got a very senior person working for her that's pretty happy there mm-hmm. and has a lot more potential, but she can't really access a lot of that potential until she gets a few more things in place for the organization, which is a few months off. And she's like, I'm worried that I'm, you know, maybe overpaying right now. And I'm like, you're thinking wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
You start trying to negotiate now after you've already settled all this stuff in, just because you're afraid you're losing a little money here because you're paying a very nice salary, you're going to steal any enthusiasm this person has from it. Right. You need to get that employee involved with you in moving this forward faster.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Just stop. It's scarcity thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects so many startups and small companies. And then it affects big companies as well. We've got to get out of that scarcity mindset and start working with our key players in how do we create more value that is not just valuable to the company, but valuable to the player as well.
Right. You know, and those are things that, again, through communication, you'll find out. You know, maybe it's that they want Fridays off, or they want, you know, they want to work from home. You know, they want to have more fluid hours. You know, all these various things, which, of course, is what we hear the millennials asking for. And we go, no, you can't do that. And, you know, obviously there are jobs and things where, you know, if the door opens at 8 and you are a customer service person, you need to be there at 8. You know? But for many other things, it can be fluid. And, you know, if you work with your employees, it comes back to what we were saying. If they're the right employees, you don't have to worry about them taking advantage, because that's the big thing you hear is, well, I can't let them work from home because they won't do the work. Okay, well, then they're the wrong employee. I mean, if you don't trust them, you don't trust them, period.
Well, I think there's three different things to that. Number one, it's not just the open communication. You have to have the right attitude about people in the first place,
mm-hmm.
right? You have to expect.
Expect good.
Well, not just expect good, but you expect people to meet the commitments they've made.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and then you have systems that back up and make sure that transparent accountability is in there. And we can get into some of the approaches and mindsets that are more key to that. But the second thing is you have, and I think we miss this in the West anymore because we're not taught civics anymore. But the reason we have rights is to be able to discharge our responsibilities. It's not the other way around.
Right.
And this is the same thing in the organization, the corporate world. Is you get the rights because you need those rights. You need that time off. You need that flexibility, the ability to work from home in order to discharge all your responsibilities mm-hmm. at the highest level possible.
Right.
And I, you know, these old mindsets of if I can't see them working, then I'm not sure they are.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they don't come to the office, I'm not sure that they're doing the work. And it's a control mindset there. And I had an agency that was very much a culture of you got to have face time, right? You mm-hmm. have to be in the office. It didn't matter, you know, you needed to live. And they wouldn't even hire people from an hour away because they knew they'd be late and they'd complain about traffic and mm-hmm. all that sort of the Bay Area traffic is not good.
Right. It's kind of like Atlanta traffic.
So their solution was tamp down, hire closer. And my first question was, do you really believe that in a worldwide competitive environment, all the talent you need for this organization lives within 30 minutes of this building?
And they kind of went, well.
Exactly. And then you got key players. And so we leveraged this. We had two key players within a couple of months of each other. Basically, as families decided that they couldn't afford to buy in the Bay Area,
mm-hmm.
and they moved to Portland and one to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, sorry, here's my 2 weeks' notice. I'd love to keep working for you guys, but, you know, right. We're starting a family.
Quality we got
to
buy of a life.
House. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, after the owner took over the shock thing, I said, do you trust them? Absolutely. These have been some of the best employees I've ever had. Then why don't you give them the opportunity to work from home?
Right. If it doesn't work out, well, then you can fix that later.
Exactly. What we end up with, within 18 months, 45% of their workforce is not in that office.
Right. Which leads to all sorts of good things. You know, they can probably close part of the office. So their overhead is going down. You know, all sorts of good things.
Yeah. And they grew 30% in revenue in 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and it's, you know, it's back to the old $6 million man TV program. We have the technology. You know, and so you can meet with people virtually. I mean, you know, I'm in Atlanta, you're in San Francisco, and we're doing this radio program. You know, so your employees really can be anywhere around the world. You know, and again, obviously there are certain positions where, and jobs and things where they have to be in the office or in the facility, you know, if they're building something, okay, you have to be where those things are. But, you know, when we're talking service type of positions, they really can be in so many places, and it allows you to get, as you were saying, the best workforce that you can.
Absolutely. And we really just need to we need the time to rethink a lot of these old patterns, and we've been programmed to believe there is a way, and that, you know, this is the right way to do it. That's the wrong way to do it. One of the biggest breakthroughs I see with executives is when they shift from right versus wrong thinking to effective versus ineffective thinking.
Right.
Because when you're right, nobody wants to be wrong. Nobody wants to be wrong on the test. But when you leave it open to say, we're going to try this and we're going to measure how effective or ineffective it was on a continuum, and then let's keep pushing toward effective.
Right.
Does it work? Great. Really don't care what the old way of doing it was then.
You know, and it is about empowering your employees, you know, letting them know that, again, that you trust them, you know, all these various things. And you know, I'm vaguely remembering studies that I've seen or read or maybe just dreamed about that said that people actually do better work when you have empowered them. You know, so they might end up working just 6 hours a day, but they're giving you 10 hours worth of work during those 6 hours.
Well, I think that for me, one of the greatest gifts I had was that my first foray into management, I managed a remote team. And I had to figure out how to manage a team I couldn't see. Well, I started managing that team based on the deliverables we co-defined and their ability to commit to those and deliver them well. And I'd been managing that team for about 6 months, and it was in Hiawatha, Iowa. The team was there. They reported into me. I reported back into someone in Hiawatha, and I get a call from my boss, who was just not a happy camper at all, because my folks were wandering in between 9:30 and 10 o'clock. She didn't know when they were going home.
And the other employees were going, excuse me.
Exactly. And I was like, okay, well, let's look at our numbers and what have we grown and what are we doing and have we missed a deadline and look at our sales, and I'm running the whole thing. And she goes, I know, but this is a problem over here. And I said, well, maybe this is a problem because you're not giving your employees enough rope either.
Right.
And so we, you know, we given the big company culture that we had, and there was flex time, we did renegotiate some things. And I said, look, you can't just have free. Just tell me when you want to come in and then be there. You know, if you want to work from 10 to 6, I don't care.
Right.
So everybody knows you're on a schedule that they have, that they feel they have to be on. And so we worked it. But over time, we moved farther and farther into it. I'm still resistant to the word empowering employees because it means like I'm giving you something that you didn't have before.
Right.
It's recognizing their own agency and their own ability to execute and govern themselves if the requirements are clear. Because I don't want people in the organization that don't have that ability. Now, they may not have the skill set because they've been in organizations that's never allowed them to develop it. I'm happy to work through the development process with someone new. But in the long run, your frontline customer, your frontline employee rather, is the closest thing you have to a customer. And in this current world that we're living in that is so dynamic and things are happening and changing so fast, customers are moving between products and solutions and things that we can't see. They are really your first line of defense and input for innovation because they're closest to the customer. And if you don't start developing an entrepreneurancy skill set within them, where they feel like they own it and they're not just putting in their time or doing the bare minimum, you're not going to extract the value out of that situation that you should be.
You know, and you mentioned one of the things that's so important, and that's it's that they need to know what you expect from them. You know, they're not mind readers. And so if you expect, you know, say it's, you know, that they're going to, you know, they're making sales calls. So if they're to make 10 calls, you know, every hour or, you know, something like that, all these various things, they need to know that. You know, you can't just say, okay, you need to go make calls. But if you're going to, you know, you need to tell people, here is what you need to be doing for your job. And then, of course, we always have that fun little line in there, and other duties as assigned. But, you know, which I always love those. It's like, really? Okay, that's your excuse to be able to pawn something else off on me, right? But if you are clear in what the job requirements are, then again, you hire the right people. They know what to expect, you know, and so then it just is a match that works well from the start.
Well, I'll take it one step further, Deb, on this. And you've probably seen this in your communications background, right? It's not how many emails I send out. Mm-hmm. It's does what I wanted to get communicated to the right people.
Right.
Right. So it's about the result, not mm-hmm. the activity. Mm-hmm. And so there's when we are most often brought in to help an organization that has a strategy, they've been in the process of executing it, and they're not getting the traction that they need. Mm-hmm. Right. So they are, it's the execution gap. And there's really, there's kind of two aspects of it. The first one's the natural aspect. It's the natural gap, right? Mm-hmm. Every goal, every objective starts out as an idea of this future state that we want to be in. And then the purpose of the work is to drive us and get us to that future state. Excuse me.
Bless you.
We have to cut that out.
That's okay. We like sneezes.
Okay, so the second one, though, is where we have identified a strategy and we're working on it, but we're not getting the traction that we need. We're not getting the results we expected. Mm-hmm. And so when we hit those, we come into those situations, we help the organization design how they are going to function.
Apologize. Got you.
it could be all the leaves falling and the pollen out here.
That's it.
I apologize. But we're co-creating this approach and set of behaviors and culture and processes and procedures. My goodness. And then there's four principles we work around on that, right? And the short version is alignment, agreement, accountability, and adaptability.
Okay.
And so we start with critical alignment, and that mm-hmm. is just like the doctor, right? If a 200 milligram Advil will do the job, mm-hmm. taking 400 is not going to help you. It's a waste of effort, and it's probably not doing your body any good. Mm-hmm. So it's the minimum effective dosage. Mm-hmm. So when I start talking about alignment, I'm talking about the minimum effective alignment and set of agreements that we need to enable everyone to mm-hmm. own their results.
Well, and I'm assuming that we do the minimum because then people will still do more, but you do kind of have to have that starting point.
You do have to have a starting point. And what you can't give someone when they walk in the door is this, you know, 1-inch thick employee binder, mm-hmm. all the legalese in it that allows, you know, no one absorbs it.
Right. They might glance through it, but they're like, yeah, whatever.
Or if they're part of that 2 or 3% that are really not good human beings in the first place, mm-hmm. they'll learn everything about it to learn how they can get around
right.
mm-hmm. all of their accountability, mm-hmm. right? So these are things like the objectives, the outcomes, the role, the responsibility, mm-hmm. the risk tolerance for the mm-hmm. project. What happens if we do well? Mm-hmm. What happens if it doesn't do well? Excuse me. And the acceptable levels of behavior in dealing with peers, and then the communication. If you mm-hmm. deal with those things to say, this is what it is, it doesn't become this bureaucracy.
Right.
Right. The more you stack onto that, the more you have a never again list in an organization of, you know, we tried that, it failed, this is what it cost us, we're never doing that again. Mm-hmm. The next time you show up to do something that has nothing to do with that.
Right.
With Mattel, when we built the e-commerce platform, we built it using engineers that had only done CD-ROM development before. Mm. And a QA team that had only done CD-ROM development. Mm-hmm. Their risk tolerance was zero.
Right.
Because once you ship the CD-ROM, it's out the door. There's nothing you can change. Mm-hmm. They wanted a month to do regular updates on the website. I'm like, oh, no.
No.
Right. This is a no, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to go through a whole thing around exposing what their fear was, mm-hmm. why it was driven emotionally, mm-hmm. and then negotiate little by little until the point, you know, within about 6 months, we had marketing managers with a tool set where they could change prices and descriptions on the fly. Because mm-hmm. it wouldn't break the system. And if it wasn't the right price, they could change it back.
Right.
Well, so those type of things.
And I love the fact that you worked through that process over the course of time. You know, it wasn't just, here is how it's going to be. You know, and I think that's part of the problem that we have is when we make a change, many times it's, you know, okay, we're making the change now. It's unilateral and we're not going to explain to you why we made the change. You know, just go with it. You know, but again, when you work through it with the employees, because they're going to have suggestions. I mean, they're the ones who are in the trenches doing the work. And so they're going to say, nah, wait a minute. There really is no way that we can do that in a 24-hour time period. You know, it's going to take 48 hours, and here's why. Then okay, well then we'll adjust. But it's, you know, it we can't emphasize it enough. It really is about communication.
Well, yes, it's about communication, but it's also about respecting the fact that they probably know how this impacts the front line more than anybody else, mm-hmm. right? And they deserve to have a place at the table to help have that discussion. They may not get their way, mm-hmm. but they definitely need to have input. As you know, we've all been with consulting companies that come in, do the assessment, tell things exactly what they need to do, and then embed themselves into the production on it. And mm-hmm. I determined long ago, in fact, we all did with ROCG, is that was not our goal. Our goal was knowledge transfer, mm-hmm. right? We want to leave the organization better off than when we walked in the door. Mm-hmm. And the only time I want to be called back in is to help them solve a different problem than we solved the last time. And so far, right. Knock on wood, that's been the state. And I've worked for some of my clients. I'm on a new project for one. This is the 11th time we've worked for this client in like wow. 9 years. Mm-hmm. We've never done the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason that is because we don't bring in a process that we put everybody through. We bring in a set of principles that we roll out back to the, you know, critical alignment, the explicit agreement, transparent accountability, and adaptable execution piece, and help them build something that when we leave, they own.
Right.
Because then they'll be effective with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't forced down their throats.
Wasn't forced down their throat. Now, you know, honest to God, I think I learned this from Cub Scouts. Our very first Cub Scout meeting, the den mother asked us to write the rules of behavior for those meetings. Mm-hmm. And we put rules up, like not talking, not interrupting. We put harder, harsher rules up than she could have ever enforced on us.
Right.
I don't know where she learned it, but I've kept that in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, we've seen that, say, with sports teams, you know, where you tell the kids, you know, and I'm, you know, that okay, you guys set your rules. And so they're going to say, you know, okay, well, you know, X number of practice hours a day, you know, maintain a grade point average of whatever. And you're right. Most of the time, the adults, the coach, the whoever, would have cut them a little bit more slack. Mm-hmm. But the kids know, this is what we're capable of. Therefore, this is what we're going to say we're going to do.
They raise their own bar. Mm-hmm. They raise their own bar.
Right.
And when you start putting things in, so one of the things I mean by explicit agreement is documenting who is going to deliver what to whom by when. Mm-hmm. Right. So once you have that documented, I don't need to worry about activity anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't need to watch anyone. I don't care when they come into work. I don't care when they leave.
Right.
Because I know that if I've asked for something, so that's the what, mm-hmm. I'm the whom that it's going to be delivered to, The what, though, has to be documented very clearly. Mm-hmm. So when I first came to California and started working with a startup, the founder of the startup gave me 5 projects and immediately, like 3 days later for my first day of work, left and went on a worldwide fundraising tour.
Oh, goody.
And so I dove in and I think I probably put in 60, 70 hour weeks. Mm-hmm. And when he came back after 4 weeks, I had 3 of them completed. I was halfway through the 4th. I was very proud of how far I got. And he went livid when I didn't have all 5 of them done.
Right. Because the 5th one was the one that he really thought was important, right?
Well, not necessarily. It's just he expected me to have them all done. Mm-hmm. And so we have a back and forth about this, and I'm a little back on my skis. Mm-hmm. And then we started, he said, all right, well, show me what you do have done. And when I started showing him what I already had done, he was like, holy crap, that's not what I meant at all.
Right.
Like, I meant for you to sketch this out and mm-hmm. find out like 20% of what you've done. And you've taken this all the way to completely finished and polished. And that's not the way I work. And I'm like, mm-hmm. great. I need to learn to ask better questions. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when he saw the work I had done, he's like, great. No, well, that means you can probably knock this out. I can knock that. Mm-hmm. I can knock what you're asking for out in the rest of the afternoon on those other mm-hmm. 1.5, and did. So, but defining quality criteria, which is what Tim Eskew calls it, is you define not just what is acceptable quality for the deliverable, but also what's not to be included so people don't waste their time and effort.
Right. You know, if they're expecting a draft, you don't want them to do the final project, for example.
Exactly. And then let's define what does draft include? Mm-hmm. Like, so if you have an example of a report that was done well that I need to replicate with new data, then give me that and I can mm-hmm. I can take a look at that and then I can answer your question. Right, which is when can you have this done? Mm-hmm. Right, but we get that agreement of who is doing it, what they're doing, whom they're delivering it to, and when did you commit to making that happen? Mm-hmm. Because I can ask for a date, but until you've actually looked through all your other responsibilities and roles and know that you can deliver that, I might be asking you to work all weekend without knowing I'm asking you to work all weekend. Mm-hmm. And this is why that demand thing doesn't work when you're really talking about self-governing people with agency in an organization.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and you know, as you said, that the employee needs to ask those questions to say, okay, now wait a minute. You gave me 2 deadlines on the same day. I can't do that. Therefore, which one is going to take priority? The tricky thing is that the poor souls of the world, and, you know, I've been in this position, and you probably have too, where you're reporting to multiple bosses.
Oh!
And they all think their stuff is the most important thing.
My first job out of college, I worked for 5 partners of a civil engineering firm and ran a department for them. And my strategy for about the first 18 months was just to keep 3 of them happy at any one time, right? Mm-hmm. And it never was the same 3. But if I kept mm-hmm. 3 of them happy out of the 5, I probably was okay. Mm-hmm. And it was extremely stressful. And lucky for me, because I'm a reader, I read Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Mm-hmm. If you remember, there's a story in there where he had something that needed to be done and he took it to his busiest guy that he knew would get it done. Mm-hmm. When he should have actually taken it to someone else, but he didn't really want to deal with that situation. Mm-hmm. And the guy's response was, great, Stephen, I'll be happy to do that for you. Which one of these other things would you like me to delay in order mm-hmm. to get this done?
Right. Right? And then, wait a minute. Yeah. Oh.
I put the book down, mm-hmm. right? And here's something about books, right? If you read something in a book and you don't take action on it, you don't own it. Mm-hmm. Right, that you were wasting your time in a lot of ways. I put the book down. I went and bought a whiteboard. I hung it on the wall. I wrote this is my first foray into project management, which mm-hmm. they hadn't covered in college for some reason. You'd think they'd cover that in engineering. Wrote it all up there, and then I just held my breath because I knew what was going to happen. And it mm-hmm. did. By day 2, the president of the company walks, throws something on my desk like always. I need this tomorrow afternoon at XYZ, 3. And I'm like, excuse me. I'm happy to do that. Which one of these other projects for the other partners would you like me not to do? Mm-hmm. And he looks at me and he looks at the board and big Scottish guy, and his neck gets red from the neck. It just starts crawling up his face. Like
he's going to explode. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm like 22 years old and he's 55 and the boss, and I'm terrified of him. He's, already. And He looks at it. He looks at me. He looks back at me. He looks back at the board, snatches up the stuff, and stomps off down the hall. And I'm like, well, he didn't fire me on the spot, right. So that's a good start. He came back in the afternoon, and he looks at the board again, and he said, well, can you do it by Friday? Mm-hmm. I'm like, absolutely. Stood up, wrote it on the board. He laid it on the desk and walked out. Mm-hmm. Within a week, I'd learned my first really good lesson at both managing up and communicating clearly, because now I sent all of their conflicts about priorities back where it belonged with the partners. Mm-hmm. I wasn't making those decisions anymore because that was not my role.
Right.
And I had a very peaceful time and had five happy partners the rest of my time there. Mm-hmm. Over one little thing like that.
You know, and it's about figuring out those processes and you know, fixing that. But, you know, the problem that a lot of companies have is we have this execution gap, but we don't quite know why or where or, you know, we don't even know that we've got the gap. We just know something's not working right.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so this covers, how do you work with companies to get through that?
Well, the first thing we do is we come in and we do some, here's a great example in terms of one of the projects that I'm working on right now with a USC Annenberg Center for the Digital Future. And this is around how do we build innovation into a culture of an organization. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. Jeff Cole, who's the founder, Dr. Kumar Mehta, who just published a book called The Innovation Biome, and Dr. Brad Behrens, who's the Chief Strategy Officer, and I have built a program that we call the Actionable Innovation Practice. And mm-hmm. so what we do is we come in, we do the ethnographic work up front to understand what's the business model, what are the drivers in that particular industry, particularly around innovation. The Center for the Digital Future has this 22 or 23 years of longitudinal data about digital transformation across all these various industries. So they've got this massive data pool mm-hmm. that they can bring to bear. And then we look at how adaptable is this organization to change. Right, so that we're setting the right set of criteria and goals. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I love backpacking, but you know, there's no way for me to get in shape to go climb Everest between now and next year. Right? I cannot pack in enough experience mm-hmm. to go meet that goal. So we have to set the appropriate goals for the organization and where they are and what their business model is. And then we determine what's the specific questions we're trying to, or the specific issue we're trying to resolve. And then how do we get the right, who are the right people that have to be in the room, mm-hmm. both to understand Dr. Mehta's framework of thinking, mm-hmm. and then to get the information from the center through Dr. Cole. And then what I come in and do is actually help build the strategy and then stay with the organization to build that strategy to make sure it actually gets implemented. I mean, too many of these innovation workshops are, you take the C-suite out, it's a bit of a boondoggle, you get out for 2 days, you think about great things, you see a little bit of the future, and then you get slammed right back into the day-to-day driving the business that you have to do. And nobody invests the time and the effort into making the change, because under pressure, we all default back to what we know. Mm-hmm. Right. And so keeping an individual from defaulting back to what they know is one thing. Keeping an organization is an entirely different game changer. Right. And so what we do know is that if you do the ethnographic stuff first and make sure that we're clear on where we're going and what that future state is, and you start putting the right principles in, then we can take it to another level.
You know, and innovation is what your chapter in the book is about, I can't wait to read the entire book, but we're continually innovating. I mean, you know, back from caveman, you know, they were figuring out how to do something better, and so, you know, we're always doing that, but innovation scares the bejesus out of us, because we're thinking we're going to lose our jobs. I mean, right now, the big topic of conversation is AI. You know, if you are in a job that you can be replaced by a piece of equipment or a computer program or something like that, you're hiding your head, and you're certainly not going to work with anybody to try and do that. So how do we grasp the fact and work with people to let them know, okay, innovation is going to happen no matter what? How do we get through that?
It begins with attitude. Every time. President Kennedy did a speech. I forget which speech it was. Could have been a State of the Union. I don't remember. But his, when he was announcing policy goals, one of his biggest concerns was keeping employment full with all the technology that was replacing workers in factories in the 60s.
Right.
Right. We are now in 2018. Mm-hmm. Right. We've, I don't know how much more our population's grown. We're at the lowest unemployment we've ever had. Mm-hmm. AI is not going to take our jobs. Right. It's going to take some jobs, which means I believe part of our responsibility as human beings to other human beings that we work with is how do we build in approaches, processes, procedures, tools, attitudes, behaviors that are going to serve them long after they don't work for us, right? Because if we're not thinking about those things, and doing those things for our employees, we are not going to attract the best talent. And the war for talent right now that we have, it's massive, right? I mean, Bay Area has always kind of had it. We now have a war for talent in the United States. What, 1 million jobs open right now, I think I read in the last couple of weeks that aren't filled. So helping individuals continue to grow their own careers and their own skill sets and the network that comes from those solid connections over time is it's one of our responsibilities as the C-suite and as leaders.
You know, and you know, as I said, we've seen it all along. You know, you had the factory workers who screwed in every single bolt, who did all of those various things, and you know, and then came the technology that did that automatically. And some companies retrained workers, you know, to do other things, all these various things, and others just showed them the door, you know, and the obviously the ones that retrained people were, hopefully the ones that were more successful than the ones that just booted people out the door.
Yeah. Well, and I would say that I have a prediction, is the hotter our economy heats up, the more incumbent companies you're going to see fold like Sears. Right, because the insurgent companies that are willing to try new things, that are willing to do remote work, that are willing to take risk, that are willing to draw that kind of talent in, are going to continue to develop new ways of working and new business models that just absolutely gut another segment of the industry, just like Uber has done with taxi cabs.
Right.
Those things are going to continue to happen. And so if you are an incumbent company, if you don't start adapting some of these insurgent attitudes and some of these insurgent ways of operating, and I think one of the ones that's going to be the most prevalent is more of the film production model, where we have a thing to produce or a service to launch or a new idea for a product, and we're going to attract the best and brightest for a tour of duty to achieve this particular result. And then we're all going to filter back out and continue to do our own things. And I think it's one of the reasons I think this entrepreneurizing, if you will, the skill set of the knowledge worker right now is going to be a key competitive advantage as we go forward.
You know, and I was reminded of a discussion that I saw on Facebook, you know, where we all get all of our knowledge, right? Where somebody was talking about the self-checkout lanes that are now pretty prevalent at the big box stores, especially the big grocery stores.
Right.
You know, and you know, one of the people responding said, you are, you know, if you don't go through the regular lines, in essence, you are a horrible person. You're taking someone's job away. And I'm thinking, I'm sorry, if I can go through a self-checkout thing and get through faster, maybe that person shouldn't have the job. You know, and it's interesting because I was at the grocery store today. I stood there and went, okay, that line to, you know, that you had a checker was really long. Okay, I'm going to go through the self-checkout one. But, you know, there are times where you're going to do either one. But, you know, we're not, hopefully, as I said, we're not taking somebody's job away. And so that's our mentality also. You know, we were, and it was funny, this is kind of like a political discussion. I don't participate in these type of things on Facebook, but I was watching it just to see. And, you know, the more people got into this, oh my gosh, you're taking people's jobs away, it was just an interesting discussion because, you know, people were saying, no. You know, we're empowering them, there we go with that word again, to do something else in our company. You know, or maybe it is that they're, you know, they're saying, you know, I'm sorry, we don't need you any longer, but maybe it's that, you know, they gave them a big enough severance package that they go to back to school or, you know, who knows what. But it is about, you know, change is going to happen whether we like it or not. And so we can drag our feet and kick and scream, or we can figure out how basically to make the best of it.
Yeah. Well, if that's their concern, then they're really going to be a little shocked when folks like Moulton gets a little more prevalent out there. The Stance socks, mm-hmm. They don't have cashiers at all in their stores.
Oh.
Moulton provides a checkout in the aisle. You mm-hmm. pick up your product. You scan it into your phone. You don't even need an app.
Yep.
You pay for it right there, and you walk out the door.
Mm-hmm.
So we're moving more and more away from it. And yet, yep, there'll probably still be some laws, and you know,
right?
Oregon still has folks that you can't pump your own gas.
Right, you can't pump your own gas. That just always throws me every time I go to Oregon because you know I pumped my gas since I was 16 years old, and every time I get yelled at by them. Yeah. You know, but you know it's a great service that they provide, and so once they remind me, I'm like, ooh, okay, fine, I'm more than happy to let them pump my gas. But you know, there's also a reason why Amazon has become Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had a discussion with somebody the other day. She said, you know, do you do online ordering? And it threw me for a second because it was almost, I'm sorry, who doesn't?
Who doesn't?
Yeah. Right. You know, now granted, a lot of people don't. My mother has an Amazon Prime membership. I'm not sure she uses it, but she, you know.
She doesn't.
And because it's convenient, it's, you know, I live close enough to an Amazon distribution center that there are things I can get within an hour. And definitely within a day. I mean, shoot, yeah, I don't care what they're going to charge me for Prime. I'm going to keep Prime, which they know that. But yeah, I mean, it's the convenience, and it's not that I'm taking somebody's job away. It's that I'm able then to better use my time. You know, and so it's interesting, you know, but then there are times, you know, and then they said, you know, well, what do you order online? I said, well, I won't order clothing online. That I still want to see. Mm-hmm. You might not order produce, things like that online. You know, there are some things that we still, and maybe it is those tactile things, we still want to see and touch. I don't understand people who buy a car online. That one just baffles me. Now, if it's a brand new car, that might work, but a used car, no, and I'm not a tire kicker or anything like that, but I'm like, oh, really? You would buy a car sight unseen?
Well, and I think people are getting more and more used to buying anything that's basically a commodity online.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a strategic point of view, you've got to keep running away from the commoditization of the goods and services that you offer, which means mm-hmm. it's got to be more specialized and more personalized across the board with your clients and customers.
Right.
Unless you want to be disrupted yourself.
Mm-hmm. And again, it comes back to technology. I mean, you know, one of the things that I love is I can sit at my desk and be giving webinars, seminars, things like that, you know, in shorts and flip-flops because, you know, the camera only goes so far. I'm not having to travel, you know, and back to what you were saying, managing people remotely. They're not having to travel. You know, we're not having the overhead of those things. And because we're able to cut costs in some areas, it gives us the ability to spend more in others.
Absolutely. And this is where being very objective about what you're trying to accomplish is key.
Mm-hmm.
Because email's one-dimensional, as one of my mentors, Alan Weiss, says, email's one-dimensional, a phone call's two-dimensional, in-person's actually three-dimensional. Maybe video's between two and three.
Right, because you can kind of get some body language, things like exactly. that out of it.
So when you have things that are just, hey, here's when the meeting is and here's information that I need to convey, email's fine.
Right.
Email's not a good decision-making platform.
Mm-mm.
Right, and people continue to try to use it for that in that communication. A phone call is much better for that. Mm-hmm. And there's some things that when you're negotiating real deals, when you're hiring people, it probably needs to be done in person. This
right.
is an example, mm-hmm. but it's just the same thing of any kind of technology. Like you were saying, there's some products that you just go on Amazon and buy, period. And there's other things that, no, I want to go see it before I buy it. I want to mm-hmm. make sure it fits.
Right. But if my best friend has bought it online, and then I know it's okay. I mean, you know, it's, there's that whole thing in there too.
Well, this is experience, and this is the experience. My Amazon story is I bought books from them because they were cheaper than the exact same book that I could get at the local Barnes & Noble, right? Mm-hmm. Or the Walmart books back in the day.
Right.
And yet, and they always did exactly, and I probably bought books from them 3 or 4 years, and they started holding, and I'm like, I'm not buying housewares for you or anything. Mm-hmm. You're a book company. I'm buying mm-hmm. books.
Right.
Then something happened. I bought a book as a birthday gift to my dad. My dad's mm-hmm. always very good about giving me a call and telling me how much he liked the book and thank you very much. And after 2 days after his birthday, I didn't get a call.
Oh, no.
So I called him because it said it'd been delivered. And I mm-hmm. said this, and he goes, never saw it. So I go on the website to say, hey, wait, this is a $80 book. Mm-hmm. What the heck here? And, you know, there's no phone number to call. And I'm like, oh, this is a pain. Mm-hmm. So I fill out the little form. And I send it in, and I'm a little disappointed overall, the lack of customer service. And yet within a couple of hours, I get an email back and said, we're very sorry that you've had this problem. We have overnighted a replacement copy to the person that you bought the book for. Mm-hmm. If there's anything else that we can do, let me know. And I'm like, oh, great. You didn't waste my time. I didn't have to hang on the phone call for 30 minutes to get this solved. I didn't get an argument at all. I trust you guys to have my credit card number and to start buying more, because if it mm-hmm. doesn't work, that's who's, you just proved to me you're going to solve it.
Right.
And so you don't even want to see my order history now.
Oh, I know. You know, I keep Amazon in business. You know, my husband's like, really? Another delivery? And I love the thing now where they take a picture and they send it to you. So you see it propped against your door or whatever. And it's like, oh yeah. Which obviously is a benefit for them because, you know, by having that quick little picture, you could still say, hey, it wasn't delivered. But more than likely, that's only going to happen if there really was a situation. You know, you're not going to con them out of it, you know, because they've got that picture of it.
If it's not there, you know it was probably stolen off your front doorstep.
Right, right. Well, good golly, Bill. We've only got a couple minutes left, and we really didn't even talk about your book. So in a quick nutshell, tell us about From Hierarchy to High Performance. I mean, you've got 7 authors in this book. It's very cool. I can't wait to read the whole thing.
Well, this book is the brainchild of the Board of Great Work Culture. So Great Work Cultures is an organization that started, a nonprofit organization started about 3 years ago, mm-hmm. With the goal to start sharing ideas among a lot of us. Doug Kirkpatrick, for example, is one of the first 6 members, I believe, of Morningstar mm-hmm. Group. And this is an entirely self-managed organization. There's no mm-hmm. bosses. There's mm-hmm. no managers. No one single person can fire you. You write your own job description, and they have people that have been there 30 years. They're also, they're the largest tomato paste producer in the world. Hmm. Even their seasonal employees come back in to pick the tomatoes, mm-hmm. Have been there 15, 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's crazy because of the level of ownership that everybody has in it. Mm-hmm. So we formed to start saying, you know, as we do this stuff as individual consultants, how can we leverage, all of this information and all these various tactics and strategies, all these various tools into these toolboxes that folks can pick and choose from as they need them, but start having a different level of conversations about how we improve our workplaces. Mm-hmm. And so that was the genesis of it. As we learned and shared and talked among each other, we just decided that one of the best ways to kind of promote this and to get more people involved would be to write co-author a book. Mm-hmm. And just published in August and we hit the Amazon bestseller status and organizational development in the first week.
Whoa. As the number one. So, and of course, as I was looking through it, I thought, okay, there's going to be a book two. I can just tell there's going to be a book two. And that's because there's, shall we say, more to write. You know, it wasn't that you wrote the whole story and it can't, you know, you can't go anymore. There's certainly much more that you can do with this.
Yeah, mere introduction to that. So, and if anyone that's listening to this program wants to give me an email at businesspowerhour@realblainstrauss.com, I'll be happy to send you a chapter from that book.
Perfect. I love it. Well, speaking of that, how do people connect with you just regularly and learn more about your organization?
They can check out our website at roeblingstrauss.com. That's roeblingstrauss. And incidentally, that's named after the 2 chief engineers of the Brooklyn and Golden Gate Bridges.
Ah.
So a lot on the engineering background and the closing the gap motif between strategy and execution.
I love it. Well, tell us one more time. What's the URL of your website?
Roeblingstraus.com. Roeblingstraus.
Perfect. Well, leave our listeners with one final thought.
You own the results of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Get busy producing them.
Perfect. I love it. Well, I am Deb Creer. I've been having a fascinating time talking with Bill Sanders. Can't wait to have him on again. Maybe when we have the second book, we'll do that. But until next time, everyone have a great day.
Thanks for listening to the Business Power Hour, hosted by Deb Creer. Join us next time for more real-life stories and techniques to power up your business.
You've been listening to C-Suite Radio. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com. This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.